On episode 461 of the 40 Plus Fitness Podcast, we meet Rosie Mercado and discuss her book, The Girl with Self-Esteem Issues. You can find the full show notes for this episode at 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/461.
Have you decided you're ready to make a change? To reclaim your health and fitness? The 40 Plus Fitness Podcast is here for you. I'm your host, Alan Meisner. I'm an NSAM certified personal trainer with a specialization in corrective exercise and fitness nutrition. Let me be your coach as you find your way on your health and fitness journey. All right, let's go.
Are you struggling to get results from your exercise and diet, spinning your wheels, or maybe you just really don't know where to start, but you want to start? The pandemic has made it clear we can't afford to not do something to improve our health. In fact, a recent study showed that obese people spend over $1,400 more per year on medical care and prescriptions. I'm here to help. I've helped hundreds of people over 40 lose weight and get more fit with 40 Plus Fitness online personal training. And now it's your turn. When you're over 40, you need to train smart and eat smart if you want to shed the weight and get stronger. Through the monthly group coaching call, the monthly one-on-one coaching call, and the 40 Plus Fitness app, I'll guide you step by step so you get results fast and learn how to keep it off. I'm so confident in 40 Plus Fitness online personal training that I offer a 40-day money-back guarantee. You won't find another personal trainer or wellness coach that does that. I take all the risks because I know I can help you. Go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/start and get started today. That's 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/start. In honor of Veterans Day, I'm offering a 20% discount on 40 Plus Fitness group training to all veterans with the coupon code VETERAN. This offer will be valid into the end of November. 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/start. Raz, how you doing?
Good. How are you today, Alan?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well. We're good. We're about to head back to Focus. So this is our last days. If this goes live, and then tomorrow we're getting on an airplane and flying to Bocas, and you know the whole snafu they had with booking our flight. So we won't get back till the 25th. Even though we were originally supposed to get there just in one shot during the day, but they rebooked flights and caused issues. So we'll spend the night in Panama City, which is not a problem. It's just one more day away from my dog Angel. Looking forward to get home to her. She'll be excited to see us and get things going there. And so that's nice. It. Right now, I'm still in travel mode for a couple more days, and we'll be there. How are things up there in Michigan?
Oh, good, good. Getting chilly, of course, but things are good up here. Mike and I have been spending some time in the gym on our new white sit. And I actually, for the first time ever, I had him help me do my one rep max in a bench press and the squat. And I don't remember. I don't have what I squatted or pressed handy, but I've never done that before. So that was a really interesting experiment for me.
Yeah, they have formulas where you can do like a 3-rep max or a 10-rep max, and then you basically use the formula to convert to a 1-rep max. But for one reason or another, and I don't know exactly why my stamina works this way, but that formula never works for me. I can do a 10 rep max, and then when I actually get under the heavy weight, I do more. I do a good bit more than that. My trainer Dave, when I was using him up in Louisiana, he was like, he says, I don't know what's going on. He said, this formula works for almost all of my clients, but not for you.
Wow. But
there are ways to do it, do the formula. And basically, so along the way, as you feel like you're getting stronger, just look up one of those formulas and say, I'd be more comfortable under 3-rep max. Rather than the 1-rep max. Because a lot, and then the other side of it is it's sort of sometimes easier to do that more often than the 1-rep max, because if you don't know exactly where you stand, there's a lot of lifts and then there's fatigue. And, that's why most of the time when you're doing this, for a meet, there's three, you get three lifts. So if you were going to go into a meet for those lifts, they'll say, okay, go in, kind of figure out what, you know, kind of have an idea. Like if you did a 3 rep max, he's like, okay, on my 3 rep max, I know I'm at X pounds. Let's say 100. And then you say, okay, so I should be able to, based on the formula. And again, I'm just pulling this out of the top of my head, but it's just, it's probably going to say something like, you should be able to 1 rep max 125. Mm-hmm. So since you don't know that, you do your first lift, you say, okay, I'm going to do 110. Mm-hmm. as my first lift. So I get something on the board and then you're going to say, okay, it should be 125. So I'm going to do 120. And then your third lift, you can either decide that you're going to go in at the 125 or say, you know, I'm going to push and try 130. Mm-hmm. So that's why it was important for me to know that the formula didn't work, because if I were to go in and say, I want to do my 1 rep max, a trainer is going to want to start me really low, mm-hmm. too low. And then I would never actually get to my 1 rep max within the 3 lifts. And right. you kind of want to do it in 3 lifts because you start to really fatigue after that. And mm-hmm. your recovery is long enough, but it's still, you're not going to know your full true 1 rep max until you're really pushing that top limit. And most people, when they're doing it right, they're typically failing on their third lift, mm-hmm. you know, just because they put themselves in a position where they just can't do it. But
that's what we were doing. Yeah. We were trying to fail on the second or third.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Good.
So good starting point though.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay. So let's get into our conversation with Rosie Mercado. Our guest today is a bilingual Latina model, certified life coach, and former co-host on the talk show Face the Truth, which is produced by Dr. Phil and Jay McGraw's Stage 29 Productions. She also guest hosts and is a correspondent for leading Spanish language networks, Telemundo and Univision, as well as the Emmy Award-winning Dr. Phil's show and The Doctors. With no further ado, here is Rosie Mercado. Rosie, welcome to 40 Plus Fitness.
I love it. 40 Plus Fitness. I never thought that I'd be talking about being 40 plus and just feel so empowered.
You know, it is interesting that we, you know, we think about how we were when we were in our 20s. I was actually talking to my wife about, you know, who I was in my 20s and kind of some of the crazy things I would do back then. And she says, you're no different now. And I guess guys don't really grow up. Don't want to grow up.
You said it, not me. I did.
But the interesting thing is that there are still general similarities. You know, you can't really stereotype and say this is how men are and this is how women are.
No, it's just a variety of it's a variety of experiences that you go through. I mean, some people mature more than others just because they've had lots of wisdom thrown in their life, and other people just have had, you know, they've had, you know, not so much difficulties. I mean, I think each person deals with different issues in their life, depending on their self-esteem, their thoughts, their surroundings, their upbringing. I mean, there's just so many things that really create that environment. So I don't know, right now that you said that you were talking about talking to your wife about when you were younger and how you view everything. It's so funny because I was talking to my husband and I said, I don't feel like I'm 40. And everybody, I mean, you ask a woman, and obviously this is not all women, just some women, it's like, you don't ask my age. Like, don't ask, like, if that's such a bad thing. And it's like, no, I'm 40 years old. I'm embracing it. Like, I feel better now than I did when I was in my 20s. And because my life is so completely different. And I think it was the self-discovery and the self-love that has made such a huge impact in my vitality and my energy. And also in the way that I feel and look. I mean, it's completely different. There's just so much more wisdom. I wish I could tell myself when I was younger so many things. Like, if I only knew that. Oh my God.
Which is cool, because I think that's exactly what you're doing with your book, The Girl with Self-Esteem Issues. As I was reading through the book, I thought any woman in her teens, 20s, 30s would benefit from that book. But as I got really into your story, which I think it was beautiful that you were just raw and honest and real, and this is where I was, and this is what I did. And you share that, and I was like, this is something that a woman in her 40s needs to hear. This is something a woman in her 50s and maybe 60s and 70s needs to hear. And a lot of men need to hear it too, because women do, a lot of them will talk about their self-esteem issues. Men tend to bury that stuff. And in many cases, try to come out a lot more macho than they really are.
We don't cry. We're not supposed to cry. It's not supposed to hurt. I'm going to deal with it. And unfortunately, when we internalize and we kind of bury that, like we just put it in the back, eventually it'll manifest in somehow it'll show up in your life, whether it's through having, you know, just all these flings and sex, going, becoming a shopaholic. And this is for men and women, you know, bouncing from one relationship to the next, not having relationships, pushing everybody away, overeating, drinking. I mean, it just manifests. I mean, when you are suppressing old memories, pain, and you don't want to deal with it, or you don't want to validate that it exists, it shows up in your life. Trust me, it will show up, because I learned that lesson pretty early on.
Yeah. Now, you went through some of the damaging effects of low self-esteem. There's lots of them, and you explore a lot of those in your book. When we start seeing those things happening, what do we do about it? Because, you know, you're really, it's a big project. It's not something that you just do. Can you kind of talk through some of the damage and when we can recognize that damage, or how we recognize that damage, and then just some things we can do to turn that around?
Yeah. You know, I think first of all, when writing this, first of all, I have to say, thank you for reading the book. I appreciate that so much. That for me is thank you. But when it comes to self-esteem, I feel that self-esteem really starts changing and developing as we're growing up. I mean, for me, my self-esteem, I really understood that, you know, I didn't feel accepted, or I felt rejected, or when I got the negative comments of being called fat ass or hippo at a young age, at the age of 8 or 9. I mean, just imagine 8 or 9, and the conversation wasn't created at home. I had wonderful parents, but I was too ashamed. I was too embarrassed to come and tell my parents, hey, I'm being made fun of at school. So I feel that it starts at a really young age, and different triggers, whether it's at home, whether it's at school, whether it's with friends, whether it's some form of bullying with family. There's just different ways that it starts, but I really feel that it starts at a young age. And sometimes we don't know that that's going on. We don't know because we're innocent. We don't know how to deal with that. We just know that we're being called names. We're being made fun of because of our looks, or the way we speak, or our ethnic background, or just for being, you know, just for being you, someone. It triggers someone somehow, because I feel that bullying really starts, like, you have to be introduced to bullying. You're watching it somewhere. You're listening to somewhere, and then you act out on it. And for me, it would start at a young age, and then it developed into going into high school. Were even more so that I already had those issues growing up in middle school, that I took it to high school. I felt fat. I felt isolated. I felt rejected. And because that's the way that I felt, anyone looked at me in a different way. In my mind, they're already criticizing me. They're looking at my hips. They're looking at my body. They're looking that I'm Mexican. And it didn't make it any easier when the mean girls in school started calling me names, that nitpicking at me, like, especially around, you know, body issues. And that really played a role, because their story became my story. I accepted that as my truth. And now that I'm 40, I look back then and I'm like, girl, you should have owned those curves. You should have just loved yourself, because I felt huge. I felt so fat in comparison to the other girls. And I remember one time, and I talk about this in the book, being in the bathroom stall, because it affected me so much that I would go grab my lunch. I didn't want anybody watching me eat, because I felt fat. And people watching me eat would make fun of me. They're like, oh, there she goes. She's going to eat the whole cafeteria. I'd go into the bathroom stall, close the door, stay there for my lunch hour. And I remember seeing these cheerleaders that I thought were not only beautiful, they had the most beautiful body. They had no cellulite. And I remember a girl going in there saying, oh my God, I ate this. And, you know, my mom's going to tell, my mom pinches my fat. She says that, you know, that I have jello thighs. And I remember listening to that, and I was like, It really triggered in me something. She thinks that she has jello thighs. I think she's just beautiful. I wish I didn't have cellulite. And not having that conversation at such a young age, really, I internalized everything. And I think one of the things that we have to, I think as parents and coming into family, I think one thing that's really important is starting the conversation. Being okay with saying, hey, I went through this when I was younger, starting the conversation to, number one, get your kids comfortable saying, oh my God, my parents went through that. I thought I was the only one. Creating the conversation to create that trust and that just openness of saying, look, I went through this and it felt like crap. It made me feel isolated, made me feel rejected. Why? Because you're opening that door of authenticity, of letting your family and your friends know that, hey, like, I've dealt with this and it made me feel this way. You're validating your own emotions. And therefore, you become an invitation to start a conversation and for someone else to say, oh, I'm not the only one going through this. And I think that for me would have been, it would have been life changing if I would have had that conversation to be able to talk to someone about it, because then I would have felt like, I'm not the only one that feels isolated. I'm not the only one that has body image issues. I'm not the only one that feels fat and rejected. And I think my decision-making would have been different, and I would have just had someone to speak to. Just that having someone to speak to creates a different environment. I think the next thing when paying attention to self-esteem issues is understanding our own uniqueness and being okay. It really comes to understanding self-discovery and self-love. And I had loving parents and they were amazing, and everything in the environment, they loved and accepted me, but really being okay and just being constantly told that having an environment where I could look in the mirror and say, hey, I'm unique, I'm different, and that's okay. Just having that environment, and it all starts through conversation. So I really feel that at a younger age, conversation is key. That is the starting point, because you just don't know what people are going through.
Yeah. And I think that's actually the key anytime. Anytime you're trying to solve this in your head, you have a fixed box that you're in.
That negative voice.
Oh my God, we all have it. Don't we have it? I mean, yes. I'm 40 and I still hear that negative voice pop into my head. The difference, and people think I'm like, oh my God, she's crazy. She talks about the voices in her head. No, we all have this negative voice that makes you second guess. It's how much power are you giving to it and how much are you directing it? The difference now is when that sucker pops up, I'm like, you need to just be quiet, calm it down. I take a deep breath and I speak my truth. I'm capable of doing this. I'm worthy of doing this. I'm not going to self-sabotage, and I'm going to change the story that voice in my head is telling me, because these are triggers that are not built overnight. This is a voice that has developed since I was younger, and being able to redirect it has been working on it, and then just loving myself through it, like accepting that voice is there, not rejecting it, just accepting, I hear you, but that's not my truth.
Yeah. And I think that's really the key, is if you don't get to a point where you love yourself, you really start making bad decisions. And you make bad decisions because this is the voice that is telling you, yeah, go with it, have fun, enjoy yourself. Yeah. You deserve this. And then but you're not actually doing it from the perspective of saying, well, if I loved myself, I would take my time.
That voice that pops in your head that says, oh my God, if I don't accept this guy, nobody's ever going to love me. This is my last chance. Like those moments also, or when you see a red flag, you're like, you know what? Maybe I'm going to let it go. Why? Because this feels good right now. And you don't think about the future outcome. You're just thinking in the moment. That voice can really play a number if you allow it to. And I think learning to love yourself is such a journey. People don't understand how long of a journey self-discovery could be. It never ends. It's always growing. It's always developing. But I think you have to be really present to understand that and understand what it takes to really love yourself.
Yeah. Because, you know, like you kind of got into in the book, is you would make a decision. And then when you got to the point where you started recognizing, okay, I need self-love. I've got to have a relationship with myself first. At that point, you were able to almost mentor yourself. You did have mentors. You talked about a lot of them. Some of them, you wouldn't imagine a security guard at your high school being a mentor, but for a moment in time, he was. And then your sort of your agent as you got started in your modeling career became a mentor, and your father was always there, and those types of things, your mother. And so you had a lot of good influences in your life, but you had to actually start loving yourself before you would let those voices in your head long enough to do some good.
And people often see that you bring such a great point. People often think that when someone makes a bad decision, goes through failure, automatically you're like, oh my God, they must've had crappy parents or a crappy upbringing, or, you know, they probably went through something really rough that made them go down that road. And that's not the case. It all comes down to your personal choices and decisions that you make based off of what? Your self-esteem. I had great parents growing up. The problem was not my parents. My parents empowered me. They loved me. They were old school. Yes, they had such great values. And even my father was such a role model. and he was this tough sergeant, but he was, you know, full of love, and his interest was always, you know, in me becoming better. The problem is, sometimes when we're not ready for that, we don't receive that in the best way, and we start rebelling. And I did that with my father. I put my parents, oh my goodness, I say in my book, I asked, you know, for their forgiveness, because I acknowledge it as a parent now that I am with my kids. I acknowledge the hell that I put my parents through, and they loved me through my darkest moments. They didn't criticize me. They always had words of honesty that I sometimes wasn't ready to hear, but they always were there to uplift me. And I had the most amazing parents. What I didn't have was my own self-love. I didn't understand what self-love was. I constantly made other people's stories my truth. I constantly criticized my hips, my cellulite, my body, my face. And I just felt like I didn't fit in. And the more that became my truth, the deeper that my decisions were based off of fear and rejection. And that led me into these relationships. And self-discovery for me, it happens to different, you know, in different points of your life, but it really didn't happen to me until I was 28 after my third marriage, my third divorce. And, you know, three marriages, three divorces down, hit rock bottom and get sick. It was really a highlight of, wow, like I really, like God really brought me down to my knees. And I really had to focus on, where is this all coming from? And then start asking different questions, because those questions that I was asking, why me, why me, why me, was not serving a purpose in my life.
Yes. And then you start to turn it around. And like a lot of us, we've surrounded ourselves with people that are reinforcing the voice we already had. You know, it's it Jim Rohn says you're the five people you spend the most time with. Well, if you've got a voice in your head that doesn't like you, it's more than likely four of the other people around you or five of the other people around you are also really don't have your necessarily your long distance, long term best interests.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in the book, you did have some saboteurs that you had to balance and work through.
They were great teachers. I'll tell you that. They were great teachers of what not to do and not how to react. And they were great teachers in the sense, and saboteur, I love that word, saboteurs. It just, you know, I think it's the first time that I've heard that word. So thank you for sharing. I just learned something new. It is so true, because when you are already in this deep, dark hole of no self-respect, no self-love, and you don't know what's going on, and you're constantly being told that you will never amount to anything, that nobody's ever going to love you, you go through your divorce, and it's like, you're lucky I paid attention to you. You know, you're fat, you're old, like, you know, give up. You have, who's going to ever love you after this? Like, you're divorced again. Who's going to ever love you after this? Or, you know, your body just grosses me out. When you already have issues with self-love and you don't know who you are and you hear those stories, you believe them. You're like, yep, it's confirming what's in my head. That voice that's telling me those same stories, that, you know, it's just an exterior confirmation that what I'm saying is true. And what happens? You start believing that. And when you believe that, you start acting on that. And what happens? You start tolerating disrespect in relationships. You start, you know, tolerating abuse, physical, emotional, and psychological abuse. You tolerate anything that comes your way. You stay quiet. You don't speak up. Your voice doesn't matter. There's no respect towards your body. And not only that, who does that impact? It impacts you. It impacts those who are watching you. It impacted my parents. Why? Because they didn't know what was going on, but they knew something was going on. I kept the physical and emotional abuse so quiet that I would have bruises on my arm. And my excuse, I have anemia. I'm anemic. I didn't want anybody to find out what was going on. Who else did that impact? My kids growing up. Why? Because they think that then I'm teaching them through the lack of self-love and tolerating something that less than I deserve, that is a normal relationship. They grow up with that sense. So to do the self-work and turn that around, turn the story around, is teaching my kids that not only did I accept something less than I deserve, this is what happens when you don't love yourself. But when you turn that around and get back up, you show them the strength in getting back up and discovering yourself and changing your story, changing your values, and saying, no longer am I going to accept this because I love myself, because I'm worthy of more. Because in life, Tony Robbins says it, and it's in my book, in life, you get what you tolerate.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's the hard thing, is when you get to a point where you start making better decisions because you've now had that conversation with yourself. Look, I love myself and I'm not just going to roll with it. I'm not just going to sit there and when I'm inside telling myself something that I'm not capable of doing something that, you know, I need to quit. I'm not going to go with that. I'm not going to double down on overeating or not exercising or alcohol or whatever the problem, whatever it is that the voice in your head is saying, oh, well, you're not going to change anyway. You're not going to get to that size or you're not going to accomplish that weight. And so at this point, you know, but you get past that. And now you've got this group of saboteurs that are, you know, also trying to do the thing. And I think that's the point where once you start breaking through and saying, okay, that voice is wrong. I see it in what I'm able to accomplish. And so setting like short-term goals and understanding what you need to move forward because, you know, as you were going through your career, you were kind of recognizing that, you know, you weren't as healthy as you needed to be and you weren't moving in the direction of your career as well as you needed to do. And so you took, in my mind, a pretty drastic step because bariatric surgery is no joke. And especially when you had it done, it was better. But, you know, there's still a lot of complications that can come from a surgery like that. But you did go through bariatric surgery, and I've never actually really talked about it on the podcast. Could you take a little bit of time to just talk through that part of your journey? Because I think this is for some people, you know, we've gotten down the road a certain way, and we just need to do some things that are a little bit more drastic to get that kickstart, to get that big win.
Yeah.
So from that point forward, the voices don't sound as loud because we know we've done the right step.
Well, you know, before I did bariatric surgery, I lost 100 pounds. So before the bariatric surgery, and I went through yo-yo dieting. I go on one diet, lose weight, gain weight. It was always, you know, it was always up and down. And it just got to a point where I really wanted to dominate. I really wanted to create change. I wanted it so bad. And I didn't understand why I wasn't successful. And one of the things that I learned through bariatric surgery and it was such a big aha moment, I never had felt full. The sensation of eating something and feeling full, of saying, all right, I'm full like that. Because when you're full, there's an automatic reaction to your body. There's like there's a sensation that when you've eaten and you get to that point, it's your body saying, okay, you're done. And sometimes you keep eating. And what happens, you stretch your stomach so big that sensation is no longer there, or you're not connected with your body where you could acknowledge that. So I went through ups and downs when it came to yo-yo dieting. I tried it all. Everything you could ever imagine, I tried it all. I had the strength to start, to keep going. And then somehow a limiting story would show up and then I'd drop a little bit of weight and I'm like, yes, now I can eat the cake. Well, no, I mean, there's nothing wrong with eating the cake. The problem is discipline, perseverance, really understanding what you're transforming. And the problem was the word diet. The word diet really impacted me. And I learned this through bariatric surgery. And people discredited me when I became so honest and authentic in saying, look, I lost 100 pounds before. People are okay to credit that. Oh, you did all the hard work. Well, doing bariatric surgery, that's even harder. People don't understand that. So if you are one of those people that say, you cheated your way out. Look, going underneath the knife at 420 pounds is no joke. I'm literally one way or another, whether I stay at 420 pounds, eventually that's going to catch up to me because I'm obese. It will catch up to me and I will pay a price for that. And if I go underneath the knife, I could pay the price for that. I don't know. I'm trying something new. And when I did that, I got so much hate and criticism saying that I took the easy way out. You just did surgery and that's the easy way out. No, because you're not guaranteed that you're going to lose. There's people that have gotten bariatric surgery that have only lost 20 to 30 pounds. Why? Because that inner voice is so strong that they keep eating the foods that they're not supposed to. It is just a tool. So they take 80% of your stomach out, and basically you start with liquids, then go into puree foods, and then you go into small amounts of food that you're eating throughout the day. When I got bariatric surgery, the first time I drank water, it was the first time, and I can't even remember that I felt the sensation of full. I was like, what is that sense? Like I literally drank and I'm like, I can't no more. And I was like, I can't no more. What's going on? Like I've never felt that sensation. And Dr. Bernie Hanna turns around and he told me, he's like, that is a sensation of being full. That for me was mind blowing. Yeah. The next step is going through the process of puree foods and then discovering looking at the amounts of food I was eating and why I was eating. I was eating because I was sad. I was eating because I was happy. I was eating because it was the only way that I could connect with my family. I was eating because it's the only way that I could connect with another human being. It was always through food instead of just having that general connection without the food. Like, I didn't need the food to connect with all these people. So that was another lesson that I learned. But the process, the psychological and the physical process of losing weight through bariatric surgery, it is transformative because you pay attention to how much food you were eating. You have the sensation of being full. Now you have, you're learning about your body and how to create energy and how to drink water and really, okay, I'm educating myself. If I have the sugar right now, that's going to make me break out in sweat. I get nauseous. I do not like the feeling that my body reacts to that. So now you're like, I'm not going to have that. Not because I can't, because I don't like the feeling associated. So it transformed your whole psychology. And then once you sit down with your family, you're eating such a small portion and you're done, you're kind of left like, well, what's next? You learn to reconnect with other human beings. So for me, bariatric surgery not only saved my life, if I could have done it when I was younger, I would have. It played a domino effect in my family because my entire family got bariatric surgery. Everybody got bariatric surgery. If my daughter chooses to one day get bariatric surgery, I completely support her. It is just a tool because once you get into it, a couple years later, you could gain the weight back. You could stretch out your stomach. So it is not a diet. It becomes a lifestyle. And that is the switch in the mind. That is the psychological win. It's the story behind it.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I really like to get into with my clients, with anyone I'm talking to, is that we have a ton of tools and strategies around. There's not one path to getting there. And there, you know, people can say something is a shortcut, but so what? This is, you're not in competition with anybody but yourself. No. You're just trying to be the best person that you can be. And if you're doing it for the right reasons, because you love yourself and you know, this is the tool that's going to help me get to the next level, that's going to keep me moving forward and not falling backwards, then it's a tool. And
It's a wonderful tool. And I think you've hit it right on the head. What may work for you may not work for me. And that's okay. Failure is just an indicator of what's not working. And that's the beauty of it. If this doesn't work, try again, try something different. And what worked for someone else, I may try it. You know what? I'm not getting the results that I want. Let me try something different. So the equation is very different for every single human being. The most important is to start the equation and end the equation in your own way until you find your own happiness and your own success. And that terminology, that definition changes for everybody because what makes you happy might make me miserable. And I think we have, as human beings, we have to learn to respect and have compassion and understanding instead of being so quick to criticize everybody, because I learned a lot about compassion and criticism throughout my process and throughout my journey and still till today.
All right. Well, Rosie, I define wellness as being the healthiest, fittest, and happiest you can be. What are three strategies or tactics to get and stay well?
Be honest with yourself. That is so important. Be honest with yourself with what you're feeling. If you don't like what you're feeling, the only thing you can control in your life is your mind, body, and soul. Everything else you can't control. It's just out of your hands. So I surrender to that. So understanding and validating my own emotions. It's so important, not seeking exterior validation. If I feel angry, I acknowledge that I feel angry. What am I going to do to shift? If I feel happy, wonderful. Let's celebrate it. The next one, affirming who I am, not making other people's story about myself my truth. Affirming that I'm faithfully guided, that I have everything that I need, that I am divinely created, that I am a powerful woman, that I love myself. Affirming who I am in the morning and at night is very important. Why? Because things will happen throughout life that could shift us if we allow it to. And last but not least, the importance of understanding your values. What are your values? How do you make your decisions based off your values? Understanding what your top three values are and making decisions based off of your top three values. Because when you do that, you won't go wrong. I promise you that. So that for me is really taking care of myself. It's taking care of my mental health and creating happiness for myself.
Cool. Now, Rosie, if someone wanted to learn more about you, the things you're doing, and your book, The Girl with Self-Esteem Issues, where would you like for me to send them?
You can visit me at rosiemercado.com, follow me on social media at Rosie Mercado, and of course, the book, The Girl with Self-Esteem Issues, is available wherever you buy books, and I also have my podcast. You can listen to wherever you listen to podcasts, The Girl with Self-Esteem Issues. I'm just so excited to be able to talk to you, and you. Thank you again for reading my book. That really, for me, it's amazing when I connect with people who actually take the time to invest and read and really get to know about the story.
Well, you're investing in us by being on the show, so it's the least I can do. Thank you. You can go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/461, and I'll be sure to have the links there. So, Rosie, thank you for being a part of 40 Plus Fitness.
Thank you. And I love the name. I want to commend you on that. I'm 40 and fabulous. Yes. Live it, love it, and breathe it, and make it your truth.
Well, welcome back, Raz.
Hey, Alan, what a great conversation you had with Rosie. She seems like a really energetic person.
Yeah. You know, I knew from the book, because it's a memoir, and she shared so much about herself. I knew it was going to be a great conversation and that she was going to bring a lot of energy to it. We tackle the topic of self-esteem. And one of the interesting things is a lot of people think that it's mostly women that are dealing with self-esteem issues, but I'll tell you, men do too. And if you don't tackle that problem, if you don't have the self-love, it just becomes increasingly difficult for you to accomplish great things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she mentioned about how she went through a couple of marriages and a couple of divorces, yo-yo dieted. I mean, and she even mentioned it could show up in other ways, like people that have shopping issue addictions or whatnot. So it's fascinating how bad self-esteem could lead you to some pretty bad places.
Yeah. And I think one of the core tenets is that I think people don't give themselves credit for the wins. You know, they'll lose 5 pounds. That's a win. Mm-hmm. Now, what they'll do is they'll look back and say, well, the last time I lost 5 pounds, I gained 10 back. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem. You know, yes, you did, but you've just proven that you can lose 5 pounds. That's a huge win. Mm-hmm. 5 pounds of fat is a lot. And then taking the next step and saying, okay, I just need to repeat the same things. I need to keep going forward based on that win. And so many people just, they don't have the confidence in themselves to do that.
Yeah. And I always like to celebrate the baby steps. Rarely do we have huge overnight success. I mean, in the topic of weight loss, it took a long time to put on. It's going to take a long time to take it off. I know, because I've been there too. But we do need to celebrate the incremental steps. And when we learn something new, we can make additional changes to get closer towards that success. So it's a process for sure.
It is. And so if you take the time to tackle that and you approach this all with self-love, you'll start treating yourself like somebody you love. And that's really important. That care, that self-care from a position of self-love is really how you win the long game in this.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
And then, you know, we tackled the topic of bariatric surgery. And I would say in the past, I would have probably been a lot more critical on this because at the time, you know, I had the experiences I had were people getting the surgery and then not changing anything else except volume. They ate the same foods. They ate less of them. And then they went right back to what they were doing and eventually were eating the same size meals, the same stuff that they were eating before. And yes, because they, for a period of time, ate much less, they lose some weight, but then they start putting it back on.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about bariatric surgery. It's amazing how the stomach can still stretch even after it was shut off a little bit. So it's interesting.
Yeah, and the scary thing to me is, and we're going to talk about this next week actually, is the volume of errors and problems that happen in hospitals. Mm. It's a leading cause of death in our country, in the United States. I mean, you know, you don't go to the doctors all the time. You don't go to the hospital necessarily with a life-threatening thing and then just die. But it happens. It happens a lot more than I thought reading their book. And so here you are taking that risk, making that investment, because, you know, it's not cheap. And even if your insurance is helping you with it, it's not a cheap deal. And it's not easy to recover from. And then you're going through basically blending your food to be able to eat at the beginning of it. Yeah. So it's a process. And if you'll take that process and use it well, the way Rosie did and her family mm-hmm. did, then I would say, by all means, it's a tool. Just recognize you're taking a significant risk by going through an elective procedure like this, and you dot your I's and your cross your T's, and you make sure that things are getting done right, that mm-hmm. you have confidence in your doctor and the doctor's team, and then follow through. You know, change other things in your life that are going to help you get to where you want to go. You know, move a little more, eat the right foods to get the nutrients, because your stomach is smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And being full, it doesn't mean you're getting the nutrients you need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She had the right attitude, I think, about, for all of those reasons you just said, but she knew that bariatric surgery is a good tool. And it sounds like her family members looked at it in that same way. And they were made those big changes that they needed to after they had the surgery. It sounds like they were very successful afterwards.
Yeah. And you know, for her, it was a little bit about self-esteem, but I think in a big part, you know, she had some driving forces behind why she wanted to do this. You know, mm-hmm. we talk about that. What's your why?
Yeah.
For her, it was a career that she loved. And she was basically being told that if, you know, if she didn't change her size, she was mm-hmm. going to size herself out of plus modeling. She was not the ideal plus model. She didn't fit the demo. Mm-hmm. And so to be the way she wanted to be, and because she was driven to have the success for her children, she did this thing and it worked for her. But she mm-hmm. didn't just do it and then eat the way she was eating before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she changed what she was eating. She started exercising more. And even before, when she had done exercises, you know, she worked hard, but, you know, she didn't have the drive and determination that really takes her. Plus, she didn't have the self-love that sustains her. And now she does. And that's why she's mm-hmm. been successful.
Yeah. It's a powerful why to have and something to hold on to as you go through all these hard situations. She said afterwards, when her stomach was about, I think she said they removed 80%. She had a really small stomach afterwards. And she discussed how she felt full afterwards, and then how she, when she did eat sugar with that super small stomach, she was feeling nauseous after she was eating it. So those are some pretty big light bulb moments if that's something you haven't ever felt before.
Yeah. And there are ways, you know, there are strategies for feeling full without, you know, eating a ton of food. If mm-hmm. you're eating whole food, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, just starting off with a you know, a salad with a lot mm-hmm. of roughage, a lot of greens,
yeah.
drinking a glass of water 30 minutes
water.
Before a meal,
yeah.
You know, that's going to put some volume in your stomach. And then yeah. when you put the food in there, you're going to feel fuller. And then, so,
yeah.
you know, there are ways to feel full. And if you're eating whole food, you're getting the nutrients and getting the nutrients that your body needs,
mm-hmm.
the signaling will work. Slowing down when you eat is another way to avoid overfilling. You know, this is
oh, yeah.
live. We're approaching Thanksgiving, the classic day of overeating.
Mm-hmm.
So slow it down. Yes, you want 3 pieces of pie, but no, don't eat 3 pieces of pie. Eat 1/3 of 3 pieces of pie each, and then you got your piece of pie and you tasted all three.
Mm-hmm.
You know, use some strategies to help you get through these times when you have a tendency to overeat
mm-hmm.
by taking the time and enjoying the taste of the food and giving your body the time to signal, hey, we're there.
Mm-hmm.
It's time to stop. You know, we've got enough. And
yeah.
you avoid the food coma and you,
yeah.
you avoid the seasonal 5 to 10 pounds gain after mm-hmm. you lost that 5 to 10 before, and now you're putting it back on. That's the cycle. That's the cycle of why that happened. But you
yeah.
win. You're a winner. You have the confidence. You lost the weight.
Mm-hmm.
If you can successfully make it through these holidays, you're going to get there.
Yeah. Well, I personally hate the feeling of being full. And like I've said before, Thanksgiving is my favorite eating day of the whole year. But I also like leftovers. So I know that I can make a plate of my favorite foods, enjoy it, enjoy the company of my family, and put it away and not feel full and bloated for the rest of the evening. And I can look forward to leftovers the next day. So there are a lot of really good tips out there yeah. that you can avoid all that.
Yeah. And if you're looking for a reason to move a little bit more, and I told you about this last week and I posted on the Facebook group a couple of times, I am participating in the Sloth Race, Sloth Racing Team Race. And it's a virtual 5 or 10K. You get to decide which one you want to do. You sign up online. The link, if you want to go there, is 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/race. And that'll take you to their sign up page. You go ahead and you sign up for it. You don't have to tell them if you're doing a 5 or a 10, but you know, you can choose which one you want to do when you get it. They send you the medal, they send you a t-shirt, and then you go do the race. And what I'd love for you to do, if you do this race at 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/race, and you're on the 40 Plus Fitness Sloth Racing Team, go ahead and post a picture at our group. So go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/group, and I'd love to see the pictures. Since I'm traveling back now, I'll be doing it within about the next 2 weeks. You've got until the end of November to do the race. So there's still time to sign up, about a week to sign up, and then you'll get your stuff and you do your race. Really looking forward to seeing those pictures on Facebook.
That sounds awesome. Mike and I can't wait for the 10K.
Cool. All right, Rachel, anything else that we should go over before we call it a week?
Nope. Sounds great.
Okay. I will see you next week.
Safe travels.
Next time on the 40 Plus Fitness Podcast, we meet Dr. Rob Barrett and Dr. Louis Frenscutti and discuss their book, Hardwired, How Our Instincts to Be Healthy Are Making Us Sick. Until then, have a happy and healthy week.